Unified with Momobo Ogoro. This is News Talk.
Welcome to Unified. My name is Momobo Ogoro, and this is a show where we listen, laugh, and learn to unify across our differences. We meet people from different and diverse communities all over Ireland to hear their stories and perspectives. Coming up on today's show, our panel will discuss the legacy of the 2004 citizenship referendum. We'll meet the woman behind the Rainbow Club Cork Centre for Autism. And on a social scene, we'll hear from the Dublin School for Mandarin Chinese. But first, it has been 20 years plus since one of the most significant moments in the history of Ireland's citizenship story. A new documentary is giving a voice to a generation that grew up in the shadow. Echoes of 2004, Citizenship, Identity and the Legacies We Carry explores the lived experiences of young people born and raised in Ireland following the 2004 citizenship referendum and the impact of the delays of assessing citizenship and securing their legal status. So joining us today to discuss the documentary is the executive producer, Dr. Edwin Joseph, who's also the special rapporteur for racism and racial equality, and two participants of the film, Toyosi Sani and Miriam Sobayo. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you.
So we're going to be talking about a new documentary called Echoes of 2024 and the outcomes of the 2004 birthright citizenship referendum. So, Dr. Edwin, can you tell us what the documentary is about and why it's important?
Okay, thank you so much for, giving us this opportunity to talk about this because so many people have forgotten about it, because we did the referendum in 2004 and it was an overwhelming vote. 79% voted, to end the citizenship by birthright. And maybe just to, for your listeners, just to clear the air at the beginning, the very beginning, that what we're talking about now is not about revisiting the referendum, because we know that, the political terrain, about migration and people coming in and out of Ireland is very different. So this is not about visiting or revisiting the referendum or even questioning it. But what we're talking about is that as a result of the citizenship referendum, what we are having is that people who are born in Ireland, who are all their education is done in Ireland. They've never left Ireland. Ireland is home for them. This is all they know. They are growing to the age of 18, 20. I have one of the young people. She's 21 years and 6 months. Never left Ireland. She still doesn't have citizenship.
The impact of that on many young people has been quite immense. Toyosi, do you want to share a bit about your story?
Yes, I would love to. Thank you for having us. I think this is an important conversation, especially right now with the current climate. I am a validation engineer and I have been living in Ireland since the age of 9. I think, the best way to put this is pretty much, you can see the result of this displacement of youths in what is happening currently and how people are feeling and, the lack of identity. I think that would pretty much summarize how I'm currently feeling as well, revisiting, even just the conversation and not necessarily, divulge or what had happened, but what do we do from here? How do we move forward?
And that's a pretty hard one for some people to even understand how they move forward, because when it doesn't really affect you personally, you don't really have to think about it. And like you said, Dr. Ebun, it's not about reversing the referendum. It's having those conversation about the impact of the referendum. And some people may say that, like, okay, it was the parents' choice to come here and things like that. What would you say to that?
So there are two key things, So the first thing is that just to remember that, it was 21 years ago that this referendum took place. And the argument was to end citizenship by birthright. So a couple of things were put in place. So one of them was that if you're a citizen and you have a child, then your child can be an automatic citizen. Or if you had lived legally in Ireland, you have some form of residency 3 years before the child is born, then the child becomes a citizen. Now, the problem is there are some people who fall through the crack. They don't meet any of those. So if they do not meet the automatic citizenship criteria, it means that a child will live 18 years unless they are in care. If they are not in care, they would live 18 years, 20 years without getting citizenship. Now, people might say it's the parents, but we talk about, you hear it all the time. We say child first. We say child first. We say we are child-centered. We say the youths are the future. I say, but then the youths have the worst. We actually have the worst. Because if you come, you know, if you come to Ireland, you know, for international protection, within 3 to 5 years of getting your residency, you can become a citizen. If you marry an Irish person, you know, if you make your application, 3 to 5 years, you can become a citizen. Then how is it that a child, a young person who is born in Ireland, can live here the whole of their childhood with the uncertainty? That's what I want people to think about it. So what we're asking for is second generation fairness, because you're saying that a child should live 18 years, 20 years with all that uncertainty. Research has shown that people who have connection, who have the legality to stay in a place, they actually fare better. They have more commitment to the place. So you're asking them that their whole education, Miriam, you know, she described as, you know, in the documentary, she described it as, you know, her first 18 years of her life were just headache.
I truly believe that a child can't be ambitious if they know that there's no grounding for them to ultimately stay, because part of the reason I was even able to dream as big as I do, and ultimately, I knew that since my mom was able to get her Irish passport, that this was something realistic for me. But as I always say, I'm one of the lucky ones. And there's other children out there who maybe don't have that parent who can get that passport. So they feel like they can't dream as big, because ultimately, all their hard work might be for nothing.
And that's kind of, that's a lot of people, like I said, don't really think about that. And people would think that, oh, okay, you're Irish because you've grown up here. But the weight that a passport has in terms of people's ability to, like Miriam said, to dream, to think, to think beyond themselves, to have opportunities.
To even apply for a job. Do you know when you
for
some of the work experience, they say, bring your passport. She had no passport to bring.
And I was asked, like, what are, like, that's one of the challenges. Miriam, from your perspective, and I'll also bring in Toyasi as well, what are the challenges of living in that uncertainty? I'll start with you, Miriam.
The challenges of living in uncertainty is hoping that people didn't necessarily, like, know the specifics, and hoping that your birth certificate was enough. When I was trying to look for my first part-time jobs, they would ask, obviously, for, like, proof of identity. So for me, I'd be going in my birth certificate, hoping that would be enough. And for some places, it wasn't enough. They needed an official passport on file. So I would just have to find the next place that would hopefully just take my birth certificate and hope that was enough for me. Because ultimately, there was nothing to fall back on.
And that's quite difficult to go through. And yourself, Toyosi.
I mean, there's a lot more that would be here speaking about all day. But I think for me, what I would say I've noticed over the years is the mental impact, the health impact that all those years I've had on me now, even after getting the passport, those don't go away because I'm suddenly signed on a piece of paper. I mean, yes, you're now getting the opportunity, but, like, I mean, the mental load that comes with not being wanted or, you know, being othered. You've had to live all your childhood coming into adulthood feeling unwanted. It doesn't just go away after getting a paper or a passport. Those feelings carry on into generation. And being othered, you know, that passes on onto opportunities, onto identity, impact, to feeling like, who am I? I think that's a bigger topic.
And it's something that a lot of people don't realize impact a lot of second generation migrants, that question of, who am I? Where do I belong? Where do I fit? And added on top of it, as an outcome of this documentary, is that added layer of citizenship, that limbo of not understanding. And can you define for the listeners as well, is like, what would be your definition, Dr. Ebon, of citizenship as well?
I think it's beyond, you know, just like you just listened to Toyosi. So it's beyond having a legal document. And I know people look at citizenship in terms of legal document, you know. So it's beyond that legality of the document, but it really helps, you know. So the most important thing, when you have that certainty of a legal document, but there's another layer that we don't talk about. You know, we talk a lot about people belonging, you know, but the process of becoming a citizen, it has an impact. It changes your identity. It changes who you are. All the love, all the energy that you came to give to the land, it beats it away from you. You wake up one day, you are almost like an empty shell. So you're a citizen but an empty shell of a citizen. And I'm saying we don't need to go through all of that. You know, you were asking something that, you know, the impact, you know, I say, you know, that what is then happening is that, you know, for these young people, the sins of the fathers are being visited on them. And it shouldn't be. For example, if a person has a child and the child has a, you know, they feel that the child will be safer outside the parent, do you know they would take that child away? So then, if for the protection of that same child, you would separate them from their parents, yet you still use their parents' citizenship, you know, to impact on that child's whole future. So for argument's sake, if a parent has a, you know, a legality or is being deported, an 18-year-old cannot say, you know, or a 13-year-old cannot say, you know what, this, I've spent my 13 years here, I want to live here. So why can't the student have the same right to say, this is my home? You know, so it's that lack of not giving that. So citizenship is beyond the legality. We love that legality. It helps. But it's also that space where you know that this is home. You know, you this is your home. This is, you know, nobody's going to wake up tomorrow and say, oh, you know, you kicked your foot against this, you know. So you accept it, you know, and you don't have to go to, you know, we look at some other countries. And I keep saying in Ireland, we can do differently. You know, we don't know how people get radicalized, but our experience, people are not different from their experiences. The experiences become who we are.
And it's really telling that experience of belonging, citizenship, identity, they're all really entangled with each other and people don't really understand it to that deep level. And especially for second generation migrants and that sense of belonging. I want to ask you, Miriam, when you got your citizenship, when you were older, was there a shift in your sense of belonging to Ireland?
It was a strange shift because most people would think it was like you'd feel a sense of happiness or pride. But in my case, it kind of just felt like frustrating or bittersweet because in my case, it was like I've never left the country, born and raised in Dublin. And now I have this piece of paper saying I'm from Dublin, I guess. But I just felt frustrated because I knew the struggles it took to get here. So it didn't feel like I suddenly belonged. It felt like I was othered up until this point, and now it's official, you know. But in terms of my own identity, I don't feel like anything profound changed because it almost felt hurtful that it took this long.
And that's a really a telling thing to say because you are Irish, you were born here, you were raised here. Just see yourself, was there a shift when you got your citizenship?
I mean, I think I'll follow up on what Miriam said. Like, I don't think a passport or whether Irish or outside of Ireland, it doesn't instantly resolve the feeling of belonging, especially when you have been, you know, denied human rights that you are aware of or you grew to find out that this was something taken from me. Time is not something you can give anybody back. It was never anyone's to take from any child. Therefore, you can't give it back. The best thing to do is place things in place where it's not taken in the first place because it can't be given back. Those experiences can't be given back. You can't give me back my health. You know, you can't take away the pain, the lack of belonging. I mean, look at the environment now. Look at the current culture. They don't believe you. The children that are born here don't believe that they do belong, no matter what passport you put on their hands. And a lot of them are facing identity crisis, which is very sad for Ireland because Ireland is in turn missing out on big people that will make this country a better place.
And it's really telling, especially like you were saying that, Miriam, that Toyosi, that's identity crisis for young people and specifically mm-hmm. in a climate yeah. where there is hostility and fighting regarding topics of migration. And I know the documentary is calling for second generation fairness. Dr. Evan, what does that actually mean?
What we're asking is that, you know, again, just to reiterate, because I know, you know, they'll be like going mad on the text, you know, say, no, it's been done. When we know it's done and dusted. So we're saying, but as citizens or as people who were born here, as a country that has equality structures and systems in place, we need to put something in place that says a child, anybody who is born in Ireland, and if you can prove that you've lived in Ireland, you've done your education here. So some places might say 7 years. If you can prove you've lived here in Ireland for 7 years or 8 years or 10 years. Give us a, you know, some people are going to come up and say, there is a law like that. We've been looking for it. We want to see that we have a system in place that is clear. Everybody can see that says at the age of 7, at the age of 8, at the age of 10, if you've lived in Ireland, you can use the medical report, school report. You know, we have that in UK. We have that in Northern Ireland, you know, that you can then apply for your own citizenship on your own right. You know, that's done. Or if you want to say that, you know, if you're born in Ireland, they give them a kind of different stamp, you know, but some a legality that connects them to Ireland, you know, not running the risk of being stateless. You know, if we say that our young people are our future, then we must show it. We can't just say it when it suits us to say, you know, oh, young people are important. What actions do we take? It was so sad for me. You know, I've not been able to talk so much about, you know, the, you know, all of the things that have been happening. You know, I've just been so upset to see that they told us, I'm in my 50s, you know, they told us when we started all these fights about anti-racism and bloody, bloody, blah, blah, they told us it was going to be better for the second generation, or it will be better for the younger people. I said, but these are the younger people. The whole of last week, the number of young people, they were 22, 24, who walked up to me to tell me how unsafe they felt getting on the bus, walking back home, you know, all of those things. And I think that, you know, like the referendum, because I've lived in Ireland before that, I think that referendum, it kind of just brought in so much stronger the kind of two-tiered citizenship, you know, where you know, that's where that all that big argument, you know, really burst up, came up, you know, who is a citizen, paper Irish, you know, non-Irish, you know, all of that. I think it really, and the way it was done then, it really came out. Unfortunately, not many of us have had voices, you know, in 2002, 2004, when all that debate was going on. You know, the black voices in Ireland or the migrant voices were not so strong as we have today. So I didn't put any fight up, you know, and I don't think many people put up a fight, you know, to even challenge the debates that was going on.
What I'm hearing from young people as well, like you said, that there is that growing uncertainty in the country that you call your home, that growing uncertainty of belonging, and that growing uncertainty that people are actually understanding and aware of your circumstances. So, Yossi, in your case, what was the role in terms of your community, your school, the wider local Irish people around you? Did they make anything better or worse in terms of feeling like you have that belonging, but ultimately getting that citizenship as well?
I think at the time, you know how things are in Ireland. I mean, a lot of things are often swept under the rug. And I believe that enough people don't, I would say, get involved in things that they call political. And that word political, a lot of people believe that they don't have a say, or you know how things are, they, people are very quick to remove themselves in their term political, or those are politics, we're not involved. So I wouldn't say my mother got any support at all. I mean, I'm talking from the age of 9 till I was in the system till I was 18. And I can't remember, I mean, you asking this question, I can't remember one single moment where I even thought I felt seen as a child. So I can only imagine how my mom felt with 4 children. And if I can't remember, then certainly that means, you know, there was barely, probably zero help for her at that time. And I believe that the schools at the time and the community as a whole didn't know what to do. I think that maybe people just didn't realize that this would be the impact, or maybe, you know, they probably just didn't think it would spew into this, you know, what we are now seeing out there in the environment and the unsafety and, you know, the hate, you know. I would say that the little help that was available would have been, you know, the little organizations for immigrants that would have been, you know, aware of, you know, the consequences that Dr. Ebony is now trying to shed light on. I mean, even till now, as you can see, there's a lot of denial. So I believe that there's a lot of denial here, and things, our culture is often things that are swept under the rug, but it's time to pull off that rug.
Miriam, in your opinion, what would that conversation be?
I think that conversation would be starting from a point of honesty and trying to understand at its root core, how does Ireland feel about non-EU women coming in and having kids and recognizing those kids? I feel like at the core, people can say that they're not involved in politics, you can remove anything aside. I think it is fundamentally being okay with immigration and the future of what immigration is, which is immigrants having children. And I think humanity, it should be the basis of every conversation. But as Dr. Joseph is saying, it's children first. But what happens when those children are children of migrants? What happens then? And everyone deserves the kind of same safety and security to know that they can walk down the street and feel like they belong. They can go to a school and not worry if having a passport is something that they need. And I feel like unless we really tackle that one issue of humanity and truly believing it, living it, I don't think anything can necessarily change.
And it's very, very difficult one for a lot of people to sit with, because children, a lot of times, it reminds me of an author that her name escapes me right now, but her book, she was talking about love, and she's talking about how we can show love to children, particularly when they don't have voices, because we impose voices for them. And from my perspective, the outcome of this is just an imposed voice for children who didn't have a voice, were not yet to be born at the time. So if there was one thing that, Dr. Ebun, that specifically that you want the listeners to take away as an outcome of this documentary, what would that be?
I think is to understand that, you know, these children didn't ask to be born. And we cannot visit the challenges, the problems, the hate. We cannot transfer, that's what we call generational hate. You know, transgenerational, we cannot transfer hate from one generation to the other. You know, most people were not even here, born in the time of slavery. Yet you still see all of that. You still hear the insults. You still hear the things coming out. That can we look at people and take them as they are? That unless we can, you know, look at the person, you know, and see them. So it's not collective blame. It's not collective judgment, you know. It's not collective. We don't do that to the, you know, to the white population. You know, a white person doesn't do something and I blame all my neighbors around me. You know what I mean? I don't start holding my bag when I, you know, if because of something that has happened to one person. So again, so we're saying that, you know, that they should know that each person is an individual, and that the collective of putting people together, that's, it causes harm. It causes damage, you know, and that we can make sure that every child who is born on Ireland, on this Irish soil, you know, because that's what makes anybody Irish in the first place, that their parents were born here, not because they put the sand together to make the Earth's island sand. No, nobody created that sand. You know, nobody can claim ownership of that, you know, so that the people who are born here, they are Irish children, and we can help them have the kind of identity where they can be full contributors. Look at Miriam. She's a social worker. Look at, you know, and these are just young people, 20 years old. You know, look at Toyosi. She's an engineer. So all of them, they are young people doing amazing things. And this is our future. Black, white, green, blue, yellow. Let us look at every child that we see as part of the Irish future.
Well, thank you so much, folks. That was Dr. Eben Joseph, Toyosi Sani, and Miriam Zubaya joining me there. Up next on What's Your Story, we'll be heading to Cork to meet our guest who set up an autism support hub. That's after the break. Welcome back. This is Unified. Now, on What's Your Story today, I'm meeting an inspirational woman named Karen O'Mahony, the CEO and co-founder of Rainbow Club Cork Centre for Autism. Karen is a mum of four, two of which are on the autism spectrum. And Karen turned her family's own challenges into a powerful force for change. What began as a search for support for her sons has now grown into a thriving community. So now Karen joins us to tell her story. Welcome, Karen. Can you tell us why you chose to start the centre?
Thank you. So I suppose our journey started when our third child, Sean, was diagnosed way back in 2013. He was diagnosed with autism. And for us, it was a very new journey. We had a two-year-old at that stage as well, our fourth child. So as you can imagine, it was a very busy household. We were both working. It was, it was a bit manic, but I suppose we knew that there was lots of challenges with Sean. So we were very taken back by the diagnosis, because we really didn't know anything about autism. We didn't have any family members that had children. And I suppose it was very isolating and daunting at the time. So we started, I really wanted to kind of maybe start doing something positive. I was turning 40 that year, and my family, my husband and children wanted me to have a party. And I said, no, what we'll do is we'll have a ball and we'll raise money for autism. So that was kind of how we had started off. And I suppose when we had started gathering families for events and stuff, I set up a Facebook page, and we wanted to raise awareness and understanding about autism. During the year, we would raise money and we would give it then to a school for a sensory room or an autism charity. So that was really how we started. And it was really about John and I finding other families that were experiencing life, I suppose, you know, with the child that had been diagnosed, because it was, again, it can be quite scary. It was very different parenting to what I had experienced with Molly and Troy before that. So that was really how it all started.
And a lot of those personal experiences are really what push people into taking action. And like you said, it was quite scary coming into the diagnosis and not necessarily knowing other people that had children that were on the spectrum. What services were available to you at the time?
We would have been through Marion House, which would have been Brothers of Charity. They would have been the team at the time. And I suppose Sean was presenting quite complex, so we were assigned to the regional team. So we would have had the team there for the 6 weeks of OT, and we didn't ever have speech and language, but it was OT predominantly. And then there was a social worker. Then at the time, you know, things were kind of being peeled back. You know, there's a certain amount that you can get to the services in the clinical stuff, but really the parenting groups that we did started bringing us, there was a couple of really good ones we did at the start and brought us together with other parents. And that was where I realised that there was a huge amount of knowledge and experience with parents. And that's where I felt we needed to be around other people that were experiencing it as well.
And that social connection is so important. Yes, the clinical support and services are necessary, but the support system around the person affected also need that support, connection, awareness as well, and empathy, because sometimes you just need to be with people that have the same experience as you. And that kind of created the centre itself. Can you tell us what the centre does?
So the centre was opened in 2015 with 22 children and families that we had interested in. It was one room, and we had a €637 budget. It'll be 11 years open next week. And from there on, really, it excelled. The demand grew. People started hearing about us. Families started coming down, wanted to meet us and know about the services. And I suppose what we were starting. We, you know, very quickly in the first year, applied for charitable status. We then had, you know, kind of put together a board, and I knew that we were really, there was momentum gathering all of the time. Within 8 months, we had to take a second room at the community centre that we're based in. And then, you know, we gradually over the years had grown and expanded and scaled in a huge way. But I suppose, you know, again, it was like a lifeline to people. It was not just the support for the child, but it was a support for the siblings. We would have done loads of family events, and we still do. And we've, you know, bringing parents together, holding fundraisers and having fun together, you know, holding events for our families and stuff. And it was, you know, really important for me and John as well as parents that we had really created a lovely network of support for us too.
And it's so important that, and it's great to hear the growth, like coming from a €600 budget, that's a far, far stretch, I imagine, from the first year. And specifically coping with life challenges and coping with building an organization. How did you cope and adapting with not just raising four kids as a super parent or super mom, but coping with life challenges as well?
I suppose it was very up and down. It was, you know, I struggled a lot myself emotionally. I suppose I myself only was diagnosed 2 years ago, autistic, and I have ADHD. And I suppose that would have predominantly been the challenges that I was going through. But I was treated for years with depression. And, it, you know, for me, I now look back and I say, well, actually, I was different. You know, I saw the world differently. I learned, but I love being a mum, and I'm a hairdresser by trade. So I went part time. John had to give up his job to be at home because Sean had significant challenges that wasn't safe. And, you know, we came out of that period and we rallied. But, you know, I suppose it was always about balancing it. And, you know, Molly and Troy were the older two siblings. They were always in the middle of everything. They were so, so good to the boys and to us, and amazing, amazing siblings. But I suppose, yeah, it did. I mean, obviously it does take a toll. You know, I was sleep deprived. The boys never slept. But, it, you know, I suppose for me, I was very motivated. I am a very motivated person. I'm very passionate about the club. And that was really what drove us to continue to do it. you know, John always jokes and says that, you know, Karen, you promised we'd stop at 600 children, and then you promised we'd stop at 8, and then he, you know, we'd stop at 1,000, and here we are at 1,368 children on a weekly basis, and we're still going. But, you know, I suppose we see the significant impact it makes. And, you know, our boys are a bit older. Sean is 21 this year. He's absolutely doing amazing. Stephen is 17 this year. So, you know, we're coming out the other side of that phase and going into a different phase. But like for us as a family, I feel there's a huge amount that we can still give. And that's what keeps me going every day. So yeah, it gets tough. It gets hard emotionally, and over the years it was struggling to try to find, you know, people to support us, and constantly doing fundraisers and doing that on an empty tank. And it wasn't easy, but, you know, when I look at what we've achieved and what we've built, I'm so, so proud of that. And it makes up for all of that, those challenging times.
As you should be. And it's great to hear that you have such a supportive system. I can empathize in terms of the doing things, running around, fundraising to keep the mission alive. And specifically for parents, like you said, you are in I'm not saying the other end of it, but you are in the other end of raising a young child with autism. Specifically for parents that are in that stage or carers, what would be your advice to them?
I suppose my biggest would be being mindful of your own well-being and emotional health. You know, pick your battles, see really, you know, everything for us is fight or flight. Everything is a fight for services and for school places. And I suppose so often it can happen that you could go down a rabbit hole and it becomes something that you do every day, but that can have a huge, huge impact on your emotional and physical well-being. You know, for me, I had huge difficulties with IBS and stuff over the years. And, you know, that was all stress. It was all, you know, and again, it's not our fault because the system isn't providing what we need. But I would definitely be a huge advocate for telling parents, you know, pick your battles. You know, if this is something that's not needing to be dealt with right now, don't take it on, and do things very, very gently and carefully as well. Because, you know, I mean, parents are under so much stress financially, and emotionally, and trying to keep a family supported in every aspect of it. You do, I mean, you always go without those things yourself, but I suppose, you know, you're still at the middle of the family network as well, and you have to be that you have to be there forever, you know, well, not forever, for your lifespan for them. And it can be quite difficult. So yeah, definitely looking after yourself and making sure you get sleep, making sure you get rest when you can. And as I say, just prioritizing the things that are really achievable. And, you know, I'm not saying, you know, they just don't fight everything, but pick the things that are really needing to be picked at a time and at a time when you're able for it.
Kind of like that airport analogy where the masks, and they're like, you have to put the mask on yourself first before you put it on other people. So that's fantastic advice. And now for the centre, like you started it with €600, couple of children, one room. You've grown it into 1,300 plus weekly. What is the vision for the future now that it's grown to this extent?
So we have secured a building about 2-minute walk from where we are, because we're renting rooms in the community centre here, and we have modulars on a site which has a licence to the city council. So we're just, our lease has gone back signed, so we're just waiting on the paperwork for them to be done on their side and get the keys. And then once we have our keys, that will be our new home. There's a significant amount of work that has to be done. It's going to cost about $480,000 to renovate the building as the first phase to get 6 of the services in there. So I suppose it's very, very important that we can do this very steady and safely. But we have our forever home now. And I think that was always the goal, for us to be able to go in and have a lease where we can actually secure funding and support from government departments. That'll be the first phase. The second phase would be to try to build on to bring the younger children over, and the third phase would be then a kind of a holistic area then for you know, our holistic I suppose, like our polytunnel and our cookery school and our adult services. And yeah, so that's the vision.
That's fantastic, and it's one that is really grounded in your heart. It's grounded in strategy, and it's grounded in that holistic support. That's, you are a very inspirational woman. Thank you so much, Karen, for joining the show.
No, thank you so much for having me. And I suppose I just want to say thank you for the opportunity. It's always lovely to be able to speak about the club and also our journey. And I suppose for the 11 years that we've gotten new support, we are really hoping we'll have support for the years to come. You know, this is a 7-year strategy, building our forever home, setting our roots down and staying within our vision of being a community. You know, and keeping our community initiatives in Mahon is really, really important.
That was Karen O'Mahony, who is the co-founder of the Rainbow Club Cork Centre. And there you can find more about the Rainbow Club at therainbowclub.ie. After the break, we'll hear from the Dublin School for Mandarin Chinese and how the thriving community of Mandarin Chinese learners is growing here in Ireland. That's after the break. We'll see you then. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. Now, learning Mandarin is opening doors for more and more people across Ireland, not just about the language that's spoken, but also about the rich culture, history, and the wider world that's involved in these countries. Today on The Social Scene, we're chatting to Evan Furlong from the Dublin School of Mandarin Chinese, a school that has spent over 15 years helping students of all ages connect with the Mandarin-speaking world while celebrating cultural exchange right here in Dublin. Welcome, Evan. How are you?
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm good, thank you.
So can you tell us a bit more about the Dublin School for Mandarin Chinese?
Sure. I've been living in Ireland for 26 years. So 31st of July is my next anniversary. So when I first arrived in Ireland in 2000, the Asian landscape is very different, you know, and there were lots of Chinese students, not so many Taiwanese. And then I had my children. My first child was born in 2005. So I guess the main reason I founded the Dublin School of Mandarin Chinese back in 2009 was really like a selfish reason. It's for my own children. That's how I started. Yeah.
And it's something that I see a lot with immigrant parents, of like wanting to pass down the ethnic language to their children and wanting a way for them to be connected to that culture, their own culture. Was that your case?
Yes, absolutely. So it wasn't for business or politics, definitely not for money. It's really for my children. So my daughter was turning 5 and I just desperately want to give her the gift of language and to make sure she truly understood her Taiwanese root. So what started as a mother's personal mission in the kitchen with a group of, I think I started with a group of 5 children in my kitchen for the first year. And now Dublin School of Mandarin Chinese has transformed very differently now. For example, starting in 2012, I organized the first Dragon Boat Festival gathering for the community. So the Dragon Boat Festival, for those people who are probably not familiar, is one of the 3 main festivals in East Asia. So Taiwan Island Association actually took over 2 years ago. So it has turned this event into a bustling Taiwanese market. It's a great meetup event for fellow Taiwanese and friends of Taiwan.
That sounds super fun. And specifically, it sounds like a really great way of cultural exchange, of learning and understanding. And I know for your work in terms of teaching Mandarin with the school, is Mandarin difficult to learn for people, especially adults?
Well, our students, we have kind of various levels of students. You know, we have beginners, completely beginners, and then some have learned maybe during the post-primary schools, and they want to pick up again. Some have been living in China, some have been living in Taiwan, so they just want to continue on their language. So some have families in Taiwan. So, you know, like there are various and very diverse backgrounds of students who want to continue their Mandarin learning journey. Yeah.
And I suppose, like, in terms of the language is different, but also the cultures are different. Is that a part of the process of learning? Because there are different East Asian cultures, like you said, Chinese, Taiwanese. Is that a part of the process in terms of your teaching practice?
Oh, absolutely. Our classroom was never boring. I suppose because there are a lot of research-backed theory that, you know, learning a language, it's not just the language itself, you know, the cultural element plays a really important part. So that's why we have been teaching, say, half and half. You know, the first hour, students will always learning with their peers who are on the same level of proficiencies. And then the second hour usually will be the cultural element of the classes. So we will have workshops on foods, arts, festivals, and etc. So it makes it more interesting. So it's not just a language, but it's also a heritage and cultural element.
And that's the beautiful holistic experience of cultural exchange. And it's something that like you said, some people don't realize you're not just learning a language, you're learning a whole operating system of a whole different world. And that's really important. How is that process being involved in the education system in Ireland? The development of the Leaving Cert Mandarin Chinese course and even exams and things like that?
I think Ireland has its first Confucius Institute in 2006. I'm not 100% sure. My school started in 2009. Since then, I've been petition for, you know, having Mandarin Chinese on the Leaving Cert program, because I think being a parent, I'm sure, you know, like every other parent who might have the background in other languages like French, Spanish, Italian, German, you know, like they would have the favor of the children to keep the languages, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess my feeling was that if my kids can sit in Mandarin Chinese for their Leaving Cert, that would be one of the, I guess, motivation, if you get me.
And it's so important, like you from the start of this conversation, your drive has been that future for your kids. Your drive has been that future for how they can hone and own their cultural heritage. And it's really great to see how you've applied that for other kids to learn about that culture and the language as well. And what are your hopes for education in terms of Mandarin Chinese in Ireland?
I suppose Mother Tongues is a organization who really promoted multilingual, started from like a young age. And I just hope that, you know, like people or parents will really immerse in their heritage, their languages, and turn Ireland into a true multilingual nations rather than just, you know, Irish and English. I think that's a very important assets to the nation. Yeah.
And specifically, like you said, you're Taiwanese. I'm a cultural psychologist, so I love learning about the differences between different cultures. What would you say is like the difference and similarities between Irish culture and Taiwanese culture?
Food-wise, it's very different. Geopolitically-wise, we are very similar. We're both kind of island nations, and we have big brothers right next to us. And we've both been colonized by other a stronger power. They are historically similarity, I suppose. But the food theme are very different, because I'm like, as a Taiwanese, we're very proud of our food. And I don't know if you are aware, the International Booker's Prize this year was awarded the Taiwanese author, Taiwan Travelogue. So in that book, it talks a lot about not only the historical parts of Taiwan, but also the food culinary arts in Taiwan, which I'm very proud of. Yeah.
Food is a huge place where we can come together and learn from each other. And it's great to hear about the commonalities as well in terms of the history. And I would love to ask for you, because you're an educator, to learn maybe one or two words in terms of Mandarin Chinese for the people listening as well, and they can go with as well. So possibly, what is hello, how are you in Mandarin Chinese?
Okay, I would rather teach I love you, because love is love, right?
Love is love. Let's do that.
And then it's a Pride month, so I want to teach I love you because it's really easy, okay? So if you look up, you have war, right? You have war.
War?
Right? I don't know what color is your war. I can't see it. Okay. So the war.
War.
And then the second word is I, your eye.
I.
And then the third word is your knee.
Knee.
Yeah, why knee? Yeah.
Why knee?
Why knee?
Whiny. Yeah, oh, that's beautiful. Thank you so much. I don't know if I can say whiny, but whiny. Well, thank you so much, folks. That's Evan, who is from the Dublin School of Mandarin Chinese. That brings us to the end of today's episode on Unified, supported by Commission of Mine. Find us on podcasts on the Go Loud app and share your thoughts with us at unified@newstalk.com. Thanks again to Marisol Sullivan on producing and Aisha Neve on research. Join us next week on Unified, Sundays at 8 p.m. on Newstalk. See you then.